CJSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.
Music and talk radio about all things, all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Intravenous here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby Campus and Community Radio from Simon Fraser University, where we are broadcasting on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Halkomelem and Squamish-speaking peoples. Thank you all so much for tuning in this Wednesday morning here at 10 a.m., or afternoon, evening, wherever it is you're tuning in from if you're not here in BC. I hope you're all having a great day, a great midweek. I hope it's not going to be a very long day for a lot of people. I know midweek always usually sort of pains people. I'm Rebecca. I'm going to be your host up until 11 a.m. where Democracy Now! Will take over. And I have a really interesting topic that I'm very, very excited to share with you all. As we know, Intravenous is all about women and gender issues. And I have been working on a series of different interviews, kind of in different aspects around the same overarching topic. So it's a series kind of exploring structural issues that impact survivor justice for rape and sexual assault offenses. Now, I'm going to put a trigger warning in there now, as I have an interview that will air, and there is a mention of rape, there is mention of sexual cases, rape myths, case details. It's a lot to do with sexual violence, and if that is going to be upsetting for you to listen to, I would strongly recommend that you tune out of this episode, and you can tune back in at 11 a.m. for Democracy Now!. And you can always put in a previous episode of Intravenous to listen to during this hour if you want your weekly dose of gender talk, women's talk. You can just go to the website cjsf.ca and click on one of the previous episodes to listen to. So, yes, like I said, I have been working on this series of exploring these structural issues that are impacting survivor justice for rape and serious sexual offences. Now, I have a lot of interviews that I've done that have been so insightful, and I would like to thank everyone that I have interviewed and I will be interviewing, because I do have one later today, which is the final one. And they're very long, so I've had to split them in two parts. So the interviews that I have done and will be doing, the one for today and next week, because it is two parts, is from the CEO of a registered charity called Justice Is Now, Leonie. I had a great chat with her, talking about a whole bunch of different things to do with the charity that she's the CEO of, and also her views on the justice system in England and Wales. So I will be airing part one of that interview this morning, and then part two will air next week. So be sure to tune in again next week on Wednesday. And then after that, I have another two-part interview with an associate professor at my university back home, Loughborough, called Dr. Dominic Wilmot. And that was a very, very enjoyable conversation that we had, talking about his research into rape myths and the criminal justice system again in England and Wales and different avenues in there. And it's something that I've developed a strong interest for recently, since being at the radio and being able to explore this topic a lot more. And he had a lot of insightful things to say. So that will be airing after that. And then the final part of this series, which will air after that, I can't even tell you the date. I don't know. That's so far in the future. Is a panel discussion with Chloe Hunt, who is the founder of Pace Kids. I did an interview with her about a month or so ago that aired on Intravenous as well. Jacqueline, I'm so sorry, I'm going to mispronounce the surname, Villeneuve Ahmed. She is the founder of the organization She Matters. And then Patty Derbyshire, who is a senior consultant at Rise Consulting. And we're going to be talking about the research that all three of them are conducting in regard to the accessibility of forensic evidence collection kits in Canada, particularly in Yukon, Northern BC and Northern Ontario. And kind of looking into that side of sexual violence reporting and survivor justice, rather than what I spoke about with Leonie and Dom, which was more to do with the trial system, conviction ratings, and what happens in court. So we've got kind of two different avenues that we'll be exploring over the next couple of weeks here on Intravenous. So it will be a couple of weeks worth of talking about sexual violence and rape and serious topics like that. So that is a trigger warning for this episode and for the future episodes, but I will reiterate that when those air. But like I said, today I am airing the first part with Leonie. So just a bit of background information for her charity, Justice Is Now. It is a charity that is committed to improving the quality of life for victims of sexual violence. So they are committed to equipping future criminal barristers and all other legal professionals with the knowledge needed to understand the damaging effects of rape myths and stereotypes, and looking at the trauma and PTSD and harm that's experienced by complainants and how they are re-experiencing it all over again in the criminal justice system. So our discussion overall was looking at the level of conviction to acquittals, the likelihood of the defendants pleading, there we go, not guilty because they know they have a better shot of being acquitted than being found guilty. We had a look a bit about like what justice is, the impact of being a juror and the alternative modes to jury service, so judge-only trials, specialized court systems. And we also touched upon the political administrative side to achieving reforms in the criminal justice system. And then we also really did zoom in on barrister issues and reform proposed for them. So looking at the commercialization of barristers in rape and serious sexual offenses, the commercialization of a justice system, the educational pieces that her charity works on for barristers, and her barrister feedback loop project, creating this culture of transparency and corrective action. So that is the overall across the whole discussion that I had with her. Though all of those topics will not be touched on this week because it is only part one, because there was just so much to get through and we didn't even get through all of it. So I really want to thank Leonie for taking the time out of her day to have that chat with me, as it is very difficult to organize when we're working on different time zones, but I'm so thankful that we got to get it scheduled and get it done. I definitely found it very interesting, and I hope you out there will also find it as interesting as I did listening to it. So before we get into that, I am going to play a song. It's a song that I discovered off of the CJSF playlist recently. It's by an artist called Coco Rose off of her album Cuddle Funk, and it's called Love Light. It's a bit of a funk soul Canadian song. And right after that, we'll hop straight into my discussion with Leonie. So here is Love Light by Coco Rose.
I'll never get back. It's getting cold, getting cold, getting cold. And I love to be on your mind. Baby, don't you feel me? I can't go back. And I know what you're gonna think. Can I tell you? When I tell you that I'm stuck like sand in the mud, your trace disappearing and I can't get enough. I know we said we'd
For joining me today. Could you tell us a bit about yourself and the Justice Is Now organization?
Yeah, sure. So I set up Justice Is Now coming up to nearly 4 years ago now, but it came off the back of a career which has really focused a lot on this kind of topic. Specifically in my early 20s, I set up a charity called Team Boundaries UK, and it was one of the sort of first in England looking at healthy relationships, sexual violence, myths and facts, and also things like sexting. So I remember at the time trying to kind of get into schools to look at if we could do at this point any education around things that were happening, you know, just peer-on-peer sexual violence, really. And older, you know, and also, you know, 13-year-olds were sort of 19, 20-year-old boys. It seemed to be quite normalised. So it was very difficult for me at that first initial step to get into that space. So the terminology that I had to use was sexualized bullying, which is really interesting. So anyway, that charity in my 20s grew, merged it with a national charity called Parentline UK. And after about 6 years of working on projects such as peer-on-peer sexual misconduct, so young people who were basically excluded from mainstream school because of sexual violence, essentially worked with them on some projects, lots of different projects. And to cut a long story short, then after 7 years, I left and moved into gender parity work and learning and development work at different sort of corporates, freelance, moved into learning and development. So it kind of came at the right time to, with Justice Is Now, really, I suppose I'd looked at the conviction rates at that time actually 5 years ago, I was really looking at this again. And I remember in my early 20s, I'm sort of 41 now, promising young people when we looked at sexual violence myths and facts, don't worry, you know, things will really improve. 10 years, there won't be such bias against, potential bias against sexual violence complainants. So I was quite shocked that the needle hadn't moved too much at this point. So then, yeah, decided to do something in this space. And Justice is now, as you know, is a registered charity, but originally it was just going to be more of like a campaigny organisation. But then, it came to be formulated because there was like a real need around it. But yeah, so that's basically how I set up Justice is now.
Okay, amazing. So what are the core kind of missions of Justice is now? As you said, it's been part around like the last 4 to 5 years. And you were just saying that you were telling people, oh, in 10 years time, it will be a much different picture. And obviously, we say we're like 5 years ahead of now. And it's sort of like not much has changed drastically.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, really, actually, it was starting to look at what is happening kind of structurally and maybe a disjointment and silo nature of the justice system anyway. So it was really starting to think about, well, what is a part of the justice system which isn't really being focused on? And fundamentally, you know, there's been a lot of work and research around the conduct of police. There's started to be some research around, obviously, juries and if there's bias within that space, if there's not. And so for me, I started to think about the people I've met in the journey of the past sort of 20 years who have been through the process. Some people have even, you know, won their court cases, and the high levels of like PTSD that they gain. And it came back actually a lot of the time to barrister conduct in court. So it was the way that they were, you know, using certain tactics to, you know, obviously break down the credibility of complainants. And so I think that's where we decided to focus primarily. And then it's expanded. So initially, we started to talk to different barristers, so lots of barristers who prosecute and defend, to learn more about the adversarial system and the limitations of it. And potentially, you know, opportunities within it to improve things for complainants. And 5 years ago, so this is why I think there has been a slight shift, actually. So 5 years ago, when we started this discussion, it was very, if we change the system too much, it's going to mean that those who are the accused, the defendants, will never get, you know, a fair trial. You'll be too on the side of the complainants. And actually, we positioned ourselves and said, well, no, that's not a good enough answer. There is space. But, you know, if you think about barristers in general anyway and the adversarial system for, the you know, the Crown Court system in England around gaining conviction, it is really sometimes quite theatrical the way that, you know, you're taught. So I just started to look at that and think, well, where is the actual lever for change? What would actually mean people would change, right? So then we looked at barristers and started to see what would really make any difference. So out of that came the idea for, firstly, working with universities. So we work with law students who potentially may go on to be criminal barristers. So we set up a program where they go and they do court observations in Crown Courts of serious sexual offences, and they have... we created it with another university, academics. They put together what are potentially, in this day and age, sexual violence, potential myths and stereotypes. So they go in, those students, and they're kind of being a measure, really. You almost call it like a civil watchdog, but essentially it's students, so they're learning. And that's quite novel. And then off the back of that, then we decided, you know, it can't just be court observations. It also needs to go into like I call it like the circular economy of the justice system. So we then created an eight module, an educational learning module on this thing called Moodle, which students go on for people who potentially or are on a bar practice course. So they may go on to be criminal barristers, but specifically more of people who want to be criminal barristers. And it goes through every single one of those modules, looks at all the contentious issues around what are rape myths, how is it used in court cases. It's got interviews with victims, it's got interviews with different barristers. So essentially we have our what I call that big educational piece with future barristers. Then what came out of that was the need again for something which is more of a push. Okay, so you're observing, you're seeing best practice, you're seeing real areas of concern, and then it was like, what is missing again? What's the missing piece? So we found that actually complainants, after they left the system, and quite often they don't get a conviction, as you know. So they're left, you know, many people, too many, unfortunately, you know, left on a lifetime of things like lithium, which is a mood stabilizer because they're so depressed. And lithium, as people don't know, is a strong antipsychotic mood stabilizing medication, which has side effects like long-term affects your kidneys and liver. So that's just one example of like long-term impacts of sexual violence, but also, you know, coming out of the court system, also people having dependencies, relationship breakdowns, family breakdowns, severe health problems. I mean, there's one individual I worked with, now I've known for about 16 years, and her story is, you know, extreme things like got colitis probably as a trigger from some of the injuries, and they didn't get a conviction, you know, and they were called in court again, you know, sort of saying it was, they just couldn't believe it. She didn't get a conviction. Even the police in this case said, you know, we really thought this was a watertight case. So it goes back again in that situation as a very clever defence barrister. But there was no option there really for feedback. I mean, all you can really do in this day and age, I suppose, was just go to the Bar Standards Board. But the Bar Standards Board is protective of the bar. That's its job. Mm-hmm. So it's going to look potentially, you know, both sides. So what we decided was between that bit of leaving court, and if you go for counselling, there's a space, there's a gap where nothing happens. So we put out a service, which is called our Feedback Loop Project, where we get either ISVAs, that's Independent Sexual Violence Advisors, who go through the court process, or the complainants or victim support witness services, to basically come forward and they tell us what happened. So what was their court experience? And then we write the letter to the barrister, whichever ones who are involved, and we provide the honest feedback. This is how the complainant found it. This was what was causing harm to them. This is potentially what could be seen as a rape myth or stereotype. And, you know, we know with literature, you know, you do have to test the evidence and you do have to ask questions. You know, you can't get around that fact. And it is to be fair, you have to do that. But so it's the pervasive nature of the specific ones which you use, which have that power. And also, you know, you do certain things and it's almost like they hang it in the air so the jury can just hear it and think, oh, wow. So it's very easy to seed doubt, isn't it, very quickly. So really, to be honest, when we first sent some of the letters, some of the we said, look, we're not trying to be antagonistic. We are here because we want to show that there is significant harm. And how would you readdress this, or what would you say back to the complainant after this process? So what's come out of that is probably some learning for the barristers, we hope, and also definitely has, and also some apologies actually about the treatment of people going through the court system, which has not sort of been done before. Also sometimes it's some real strong rebuffals, but really for us, then what we do, if this is one specific barrister, we do tell them there'll be another court observation of them. 6 months, 12 months, and 18 months. So we're looking to see if the conduct has changed, and if the complainants again are going through that. But that's a missing piece. There's also the piece about the solicitors. The solicitors are the ones who actually commission the barristers. So the solicitors, and when you look at solicitor websites, for example, it's, you know, the way that they actually push the narrative around sexual violence is extremely, you know, they are lying, we will get you off. Da, 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 da. It's pushing a culture of barristers to actually be extremely commercial when they're looking at this topic. So for them, we also go back to the solicitors and say, this barrister has been flagged as causing significant harm to a number of complainants. What is your corrective action? What is your, you know, what is your feedback? So by doing this, nobody's ever done this before. It's and I call it, luckily I have a divergent mind. So I have a dyslexia, and it was said that when you're dyslexic, you can see certain patterns and you open up. This is what they found some research recently, but really for me, it's just thinking, well, you're complainant, you know, you've gone through such a horrendous experience anyway, and then you come out of the system, it's like you're dumped. And where do you go from there? So at least trying to get some form of closure in the sense that you've had a say and people know that what they've done or how they've treated you. Yes, they may frame it as it's just completely what I have to do in my role, but actually people know when they've been overzealous advocacy. It's known. I mean, for example, I recently had a case of somebody who, you know, just things like, it was actually the prosecuting barrister as well, was making jokes at the end. There's so much that comes along. So in a long answer to you, our key pieces are the educational piece with future barristers and our feedback loop project, which aims to promote a culture of, I suppose you could say, more of a culture of transparency and, you know, corrective action, apologies, but mainly a data, because data is really important in this space. So gaining the data to show, you know, let's say, for example, in Yorkshire, there's a high level of complainants who come out of that system and feel their level of harm was extreme because of this. Or you could go to somewhere like Reading, where, for example, the past year, there's been an upturn in complainants feeling that they were treated more respectfully. So, but national patterns and data is another thing which the Crown Court system just doesn't give you. If you don't go out there and get it, you'll be criticised for it being biased, but there's no other option.
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously you have worked with one of my professors, Dom, and I've been reading a couple of his papers about looking at how he can write these papers, and it's at the end of every paper, it's always, however, this is always limited because we can't actually study the jurors. Because of this, trying to keep up with the fairness and the impartiality of the justice system when it comes to the actual trial and jury decision making, you're very limited in actually being able to research where the bias is coming in, where there's unfairness in the trial and things like that. Because you can do all the mock trials you want, but you'll always get criticized. Well, that was a mock trial, it wasn't a real one. I do find it interesting the focus that you've got on the barristers and the legal professionals, because I did read this in one of his papers about how significant it is with like barristers utilizing rape myths to invoke kind of a sense of bias in the jury just by dropping it in of being like, oh, but did you notice she was out drinking then or something? And not explicitly saying anything, but just dropping a little sentence in like that, which I find really interesting as well, because over here, I'm not sure if you've heard about what's happening in Canada, but there is a case going on at the moment of a sexual assault trial with five members of a Canadian junior hockey team against a woman. And it's very interesting because they've now made it a judge-only trial because the jury was dismissed twice due to defense lawyers of one of the hockey players laughing and whispering and making jokes about the jury. And one of the members of the jury sent a note to the judge, and because it's been dismissed twice, they've just made it judge-only. And there's something kind of, I think, similar happening with the Diddy trial to do with he's been threatened to be banned from court because he's making faces at the jury, nodding and being really expressive towards the jury. So I do find it interesting that you have these programs, and I think it's amazing that you have these programs that are focusing on the legal professionals, because it isn't just a case of members of the jury having potentially going in with the rape myth bias, but it's also the legal professionals utilizing that kind of little area as well.
I mean, absolutely. And one of the interviews we have actually in our course is with a barrister who now prosecutes. He's very high up. You have sort of levels, and he's a KC and King's Counsel. And he does this really open, honest interview of us. And he said, you know, when I was a junior counsel and he was defending in serious sexual offences, rape trials, he said, I was very uncomfortable with my high level of acquittals that I got. And he said, I felt very uncomfortable. And he actually said, so I put to him, I put to him, so are you saying, you know, you feel that people, ultimately guilty people, walked free? And he said, to a level, yes. You know, and I've heard that a few times, actually, from people. So it's interesting, this is in Canada. It's just lack of respect. And also, I think there's, I think sometimes, I've really noticed there's like sometimes a minimization of the impact of sexual violence. I do think as a culture and a society,